This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we honor the legacy and life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. We talk about Dr. King's revolutionary legacy and its relevance for the 21st century. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. In the next hour, we honor the legacy and life of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Our listeners know all too well that the Nobel Peace Prize laureate was shot on April 4, 1968, 51 years ago. Not so well known is the radical Dr. King, who said in the last months of his life, quote, "Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. With this powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo." Joining us are special guests Ruby Sales, the founder and director of the Spirit House Project, a national organization that uses the arts, research, education, action, and spirituality to bring diverse peoples together to work for racial, economic, and social justice, as well as for spiritual maturity. A lifelong organizer, scholar, and public theologian in the areas of civil, gender, and other human rights, she was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and served as national convener of the Make Every Church a Peace Church movement. Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, Executive Director of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, and author and activist Matt Meyer, who is a board member of the A.J. Mustey Institute. Dr. King began his close ties with A.J. Mustey and with the FOR during the Montgomery bus boycott, when FOR staff members Bayard Rustin and Glenn Smiley came to Alabama to support local efforts nonviolently challenging racial segregation. Dr. King developed a special relationship with former FOR chairman A.J. Mustey, whose absolute pacifism King had, as a theological seminary student, once questioned. Before heading FOR, Mustey was a prominent labor leader, helping to found the Militant Congress of Industrial Organizations. And Dr. King, of course, was killed exactly 1 year after taking a staunch anti-Vietnam War position and in the midst of supporting a significant strike of sanitation workers, linking, as he had been doing, issues of race, class, and violence, as Dr. King himself deepened a critique of the roots of oppressive U.S. society. Today, we talk about Dr. King's revolutionary legacy and its relevance for the 21st century. Welcome all to Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here again, and it's especially great to have extraordinary guests. We're joined here by Ruby Sales, a truly iconic figure from the Southern Black-led Freedom Movement. We're also here with Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, the new executive director of Fellowship of Reconciliation.
Hi.
So we're going to start off with Ruby. And Sister Ruby, it's so great to have you here. And I guess
Thank
we want to just...
It's my pleasure to be here.
Hi, Ruby.
Hi, Heidi.
We just want to start off with your general reflections. We know you've been writing and speaking a lot about not just Dr. King himself, who, of course, you knew and worked with, but King's legacies and his radical roots in the Southern movements and, of course, the Southern Black-led freedom movements that have come to be known as civil rights.
I think it's important to understand, first and foremost, that the movement of which King was a part could only have happened in the Southern soul because of the particular theology that grew up during enslavement. It was a redemptive theology predicated on agape, and it understood that in order to deal with civil rights or any rights, you had to first of all have a transcendental expression, And so black folk who migrated to the North lost that spiritual root. And when you look at movements in the North, which black people were a part of and participated in, two things you notice: that they either had progressive roots, which was a highly materialist movement, or they had roots that did not, they were not rooted in any spiritual impulse. Their movements were highly materialistic. Segregation required black folk to continue to develop a theology that reinforced their somebody-ness in a world that said that they were second-class citizens and second-class human beings. It was that continuation of that impulse to matter and to be somebody that created the Southern Freedom Movement and gave birth to freedom fighters like Martin Luther King.
King was a radical. I mean, we've heard you talk about Beyond Vietnam and the work in the last years of his life, but you've also asserted that King was a radical long before 1967, based on those roots. We'd love to hear you say more about that.
Well, first of all, it was a radical departure for a black man to stand up and speak in the South, where to speak was a death sentence, was a capital offense punishable by death. It was a radical departure from Southern apartheid for a group of black people to stand up and step outside of our place and assert our right to have a voice and to assert our right to be citizens in a society that said that we were non-citizens. So King's whole beginning, the minute he stepped outside and asserted himself as a full human being and the rights of citizenship, along with other black people, that was a radical departure from business as usual during Southern apartheid.
Ruby, can you talk a bit about your own experiences and your interactions with Dr. King?
Well, I was part of SNCC. And SNCC and Dr. Martin Luther King, we had lots of encounters. And we would gather at the Hotel Benmore, which was a gathering spot for young activists and older black ones and white ones. And King would always come in, and he was always dressed to the nines. And he would always come into the Hotel Benmore restaurant and offer to set us up and to offer to buy us a drink. And we were always disappointed that the drink was not a beer but a Coca-Cola. But we had some intergenerational friction over the question, because we were foot soldiers. We were in the line of fire every day, and we thought that we did the hard work, and King got the credit. But having an intergenerational conflict was not the same thing as utter disrespect and contempt. And so we had an ambivalent feeling. On the one hand, we resented him. On the other hand, we deeply loved him. So he decided that he would come to Lowndes County one time, and Stokely and the rest of us got together and said that when King comes, we're not going to fall down and worship him the way these peasants do. We're not going to even say anything. I don't care how well he preaches. We're not going to even say amen. We're just going to stare at him and let him know that we will not be persuaded the way the rest of these people will be. But when he started preaching, I looked over to my right, and Stokely Carmichael, before he could stop himself, was on his feet. And then I looked to my left, and Bob Mance was on his feet. And then I couldn't contain myself, and I was on my feet. And we just had to look at each other sheepishly and say, boy, that man can sure preach. But the point of the story is that despite our intergenerational friction, we were bound together by a common reality and a common black folk theology. And so that despite all of what we disagreed with, that bond was greater than our disagreements.
Miss Ruby, you talk about moments of transcendence and even experience of transcendence for black people in the South. And I'm wondering, especially after hearing this story that you just shared with us, were there other moments of transcendence for you as a black woman fighting alongside, working alongside these men.
Well, see, you're creating a bifurcation that's mm-hmm. that's modern, that did not mm-hmm. exist mm-hmm. when we were part of a Southern Freedom Movement, because mm-hmm. we were so pressed up against the wall. Mm-hmm. The urgency was so great that we could not focus on how we were different, that our survival depended upon coming, standing in a common vision and a common mission. And we did not see ourselves within those constructs at that moment, because we were in a war mm-hmm. and we had to depend on each other to survive. Mm-hmm. We lived in a freedom house that was constantly under the threat of being bombed. We were living in a freedom house where white men were night riders who came by the freedom house practically every other night to threaten us. We lived in a war zone where when we were right on Highway 80, suddenly out of nowhere, white men would come in a pickup truck with guns hanging out, shotguns hanging out the window, and you and Stokely would always drive, and so you could not get caught up in that kind of bifurcation in a situation where you were on the front line in a war. And so how we understood I was 17 years old, and I was given a neighborhood in Lowndes County of 2,000 residents. I was young, I was black, and I was female, but nobody doubted my ability to do that work. And so that when you're in a war, those mm-hmm. issues of divisions become less important, because you've got to trust each other. Your life is in the other person's hand. You don't have the luxury of debating the theological or philosophical differences that you have. What you've got to try to figure out is, how do you stand together against all of these assaults as a unit? And so that was not a question that I entertained, or even none of us entertained in the movement. White women began to entertain that question much readily than black women did, because black women did not see the necessity of entering into that conversation in such an urgent crisis when our community was being, whatever weapon of war was being arrayed against our community.
Like, what do we need to learn from that for today?
I think that what we have come to understand is that the particularities are as important as the universality, mm-hmm. that you have to really speak in tongues. And so that in order to stand together, we must begin to speak from the wholeness of all of our identities, while without allowing a dialectic where one identity pits us against another person's identity. And so that we have got to stop othering each other, even when we disagree. And there's a way in which I think you have a debate within a community that does not split the community to pieces. And I think what we learn from white supremacy is that when we disagree with people, we have to banish them and they become other. So how do we have a conversation of just where we disagree with each other, but what we always hold fast to the belief that we can provide path, that no one is entrapped by their history, that everybody has a possibility and everybody has the potential to become something different tomorrow than what they were yesterday. And so that I think our job is not to become judges, but to provide pathways of redemption that gets all of us out of the moral nihilism of white supremacy and all of the isms that strangle and retard the growth of our humanity.
I just got goosebumps when you lifted this image of speaking in tongues, because that really is about bringing everything that we are and speaking truth, but hearing each other, making space for each other to be heard. And I literally just got goosebumps, because that's an absolutely amazing, deeply spiritual reality.
Yes, I mean, because what white supremacists tell us in a culture of whiteness, that we can only speak with one tongue, mm. and that tongue is the color of our skins. And so that's the only identity that gives us the legitimacy of existence. But what we have to understand is that even within black America, we're not a monolith. That although all black people carry the stigma of blackness in a white supremacist society, because of my history as being a descendant of a community of enslaved people who formed a counterculture, a resistance and accommodation that incorporated modalities that grew up out of the fields and plantations, and that turned site plantation fields that were intended to be sites of terror, turned them into zones of hope and redemption.
We're going to turn to my colleague and friend, Reverend Dr. Emma Jordan Simpson, who's a new executive director of Fellowship of Reconciliation, but with a deep, rich history as a senior pastor at Concord Baptist Church in Brooklyn, not senior, junior.
Executive pastor.
You see, I always get those religious titles wrong.
There is a senior.
And, of course, as a former executive director of the New York State branch of Children's Defense Fund, at this particular moment, really bring it up to today, as a faith-based person, as an organizer, as a spiritual person, what do you see as our work in this time of crisis?
Mm-hmm. Well, first I want to say that thanks and gratitude to everyone. I want to say that our work is to wake up, and to strengthen, what remains. And I'm going to refer back to that because that is something that Dr. King used. It's a phrase that he used when he was encouraging the staff of SCLC. First, I want to say something about spirituality, because this work is not just pedestrian. And it is not the kind of work that we can do on our own, and only using what we can see in front of our eyes. There are two elements of what I saw in Dr. King's spirituality that really resonated with me. They still resonate with me, feed me, and I try to model that. I guess I need to say also that when I say spirituality for Martin Luther King, I'm talking about the understanding of the basic and fundamental belief that we are all created by God, by the divine, by however we want to name God. We are all created by God. We are God's creation. We are created in the image of God. There are no two or three or four classes of God's creation. And that I think for Martin Luther King, living with others who were also created in the image of God, breathing the breath that God loaned to them, and pursuing a life that honored that belief for him and for others, that effort was one about trying to live in right relationship, right? Trying to be in right relation, and to see the work of his faith and the work of justice to be more than just personal discipleship. This was not an individualistic sort of faith. And so I don't think that spirituality is radical if it's not rooted in, if it's only concerned with the self. That's not radical spirituality. In fact, I don't know what that is. and there's another side of this that I think is, we need to talk about, that it's a bit dangerous, because oppressed peoples have always been admonished to be selfless. And so this is not a self-negating, selfless spirituality. We are not less than other people. And Dr. King certainly did not see us or see himself as less than other people. It was a spirituality rooted in an understanding, however, that this was not just about ourselves, that this movement was not just about the freedom of Black people, that the point of the movement was also to free everyone. It may have begun in the passions of what it meant to be Black in this country at that time, but the effort was to make us all free. And there's a quote from Strength to Love, that, you know, I really appreciate. He says, one day we shall win freedom, but not for ourselves, not just for ourselves. We shall so appeal to your heart and conscience that we shall win you in the process. And our victory will be a double victory. That's some graduate level spirituality. That is that, and it's so difficult to hear a lot of the conversation we have today, what passes for spirituality, because it is not this graduate level understanding that if we are going to be free, we are all going to be free. If we are all going to be seen as as created by God, we are all created by God, and we are all due the rights associated with that. So this work, the movement was never just about the freedom of Black people. This was also, like, it was a little difficult for me, growing up in Newark, to relate to some of what I heard people talking about Martin Luther King. My earliest memories were of the 1967 uprising in Newark, the incredible violence and the guns of the National Guard. Those images are etched in my mind. And soon after Dr. King's death, I think that people began to lionize him and to take him out of context, to talk about that dream and to not talk about the nightmare that he saw, and to not talk about this conviction about poverty in this country. And so it was difficult for me as a young person growing up in Newark, New Jersey, 1960s, 1970s, to relate to that. And I did not really pursue an understanding of Dr. King until I got to college, until I got to Fisk University in Nashville, Tennessee, and I heard the stories of John Lewis, and I heard the stories of Diane Nash, and how they were inspired, inspired not just by him, but by that work. So, you know, I'm really grateful for that. I want to say that for Martin Luther King, I also think that this is because of faith, not as as an aside, but that the quest for freedom and for human dignity and civil rights, the quest for us all to be free, was, there is no way to separate that quest from what it meant to understand himself, for us to understand ourselves as children of God. So there's a way to be free. The ends does not justify the means. There is a way for us to pursue this freedom. And I think about, when I think about, like, contemporary images, I'm thinking about one of the images that moves me so much from contemporary Black Lives Matter. And there is the image of the militarized, heavily militarized police response to peaceful protest, and there is a woman just standing in front, you know, of these guns, and she's just standing there. And there is something incredibly powerful about that image, but also, you know, something that, makes me afraid, because people don't respect the power of spirituality. The second thing about this radical, what I see as Dr. King's radical spirituality that I don't hear much talked about, is that there was a point when he pleaded with his staff. I think this was 1967. He pleaded with the staff not to shrink from lost causes and not to shrink from being associated with people who were considered to be the outcasts. This work isn't easy. This work is not easy. And I think the question, the most important question for me when I think about it is, you know, I'm asking, you know, what's your lost cause and who are your crew? You know, what are you trying, what are you pursuing right now with respect to justice? And who are you pursuing it with? And who is the voice of that? And I think about the contemporary Poor People's Campaign. I want to hear poor people's voices. You know, it is not a lost cause. I want to hear poor people's voices. But he said something to them. He said, in this effort to encourage them, he said, I would hope that we in SCLC are the custodians of hope. And I'm not talking about some kind of superficial optimism, which is a little more than magic. He said, I'm talking about the kind of hope that has an in spite of quality. Mm-hmm. That this is the kind of hope that doesn't come from taking a survey and seeing that this is absolutely something that we can do. This is the kind of hope that inspires people to pursue justice and to do that even if it looks like they absolutely, you know, are not going to win. It's about getting out there.
May I just say something,
yes,
about the hope, Emma? I think that we have to go back and visit that sermon that you just referenced that people have misunderstood.
Yes.
I Have a Dream.
Mm-hmm.
I Have a Dream was a radical statement. It was a statement based on Isaiah's vision of a new world coming and the kingdom of God coming on earth. It was a radical vision that said that I imagine the work that we are doing will create the transactional results that will create a situation where all people could sit down, all children could sit around a common table. I have a dream that my grandchild will not be an invisible element in American society. The dream was not separated from the word.
Mm-hmm.
It
mm-hmm.
was people who did not understand the transcendental impulse that every movement that has survived and that has been a powerful movement, including Gandhi's movement, started out expressing a transcendental impulse
mm-hmm.
that resided in the hearts of people, no matter who they were, no matter their differences.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see that even in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. That is not a transactional statement. That's a transcendental statement. So I think that we have to understand that King's spiritual call was for us to make a connection between who we are in the inside and how we live on the outside. He felt that we lived in a capitalist materialist society that dismembered us, that made us believe that we could say one thing and live another way, that we could have a contaminated inside and create a just society. And so he was calling on us to really rethink how we saw the world and how we saw injustice. When he raised the question, where do we go from here, from chaos to community, that was a radical statement that was saying to us, look, I want to let you know that contrary to what you've been told, injustice is lawlessness. Injustice breeds chaos. Injustice causes people who say that they represent the law to break the law. Injustice is disharmony. And so he was asking, are we going to continue to maintain the disharmony of segregation, the disharmony of de facto of segregation? Are we going to move to that beloved community, to that community where all life has a value and currency? And I think that we must remember, as we celebrate and think about his legacy, that Dr. Martin Luther King and the ordinary black people of which he sat himself beside was breaking down walls
mm-hmm.
that began with the doctrine of discovery. Walls that force Native indigenous people to be on reservations, walls in barrios, walls that turn black and brown communities into ghettos, walls that as growing up in the segregated South, I was contained by walls. America has never gotten over its white supremacist fascination with walls, because walls are necessary in order to leave some people out in order to maintain white supremacy. So I think that we have to look at what Martin Luther King was saying in light of where we are today. Why is it that some 60 or 50 years later, white America is still preoccupied with the business of building walls? And why are walls necessary in a growing society that is becoming majority people of color, black and brown? Why are walls urgent today? And why is democracy under attack? Democracy threatens white nationalism when white people are no longer the majority. Mm-hmm. So we've got to really begin to look at what is it, what is the hunger that drives, the spiritual hunger that drives the West that cannot be filled? What is the hunger that cannot be filled with power, has not been able to be filled with materialism? It's not a material hunger. Mm-hmm. It's a spiritual hunger that goes to the very soul of what it means to create a spirituality and an ideology of otherness and idolatry. What does it mean when you require people to bow down and worship at the altar of whiteness?
I think that you hit this right on the head. And when I think about this speech, which it makes me so angry what this country has done with this speech, because what we've done is to turn it into a soundbite so that we only hear and share the ending of this speech. And if we want to talk about like where people can start to even try to figure out what is this hunger that Dr. King certainly was trying to lift up, they need to go to the beginning of this speech to read the whole thing. And what's most powerful to me is I know that this was not the first time that he gave this speech, that this was really the culmination of the dialogue, the spirituality, the being with the people. There were pieces of this speech that were added along the way as he was talking, preaching to people, preaching with people, and people preaching back to him. And so it was really hard to understand. Even, what does it mean? It's hard to understand that if you don't go back to the very beginning of it. Then and only then can you understand what that dream is, because he wasn't talking about something that we already had. And it was not this superficial, it was not the superficial hope. That's not what he was talking about.
No, I think he was talking about pragmatic hope, pragmatic optimism. I think you make a very good point.
Yeah.
He was not talking about an abstract, but I do think it was that pragmatic hope that King continued, that King expressed in the I Have a Dream speech that allowed Sterling Brown to write that great poem, Strong People Keep A Coming.
Yeah.
No matter what America did to black folk, strong people kept a coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that at the heart of all of the work that black folk did, I think this spiritual that we carved out during enslavement that said, I love everybody, I love everybody in my heart, and you can't hate me. That was not some romantic notion. They had seen what hate did to the white person. They had seen the manifestation of hate and the cruelty of enslavement, and they were determined that they might be enslaved, but they would not allow whiteness to contaminate their spirits, and they would not become like the very people who had enslaved them. So it was an intentional theology that offered a way out of the moral nihilism of enslavement, and what was going on in the South provided a pathway for both black and white people, brown people, that provided a pathway straight to the heart of democracy. And in that sense, it was deeply radical, deeply spiritual, and deeply revolutionary. And I think that what has happened is that people have merged or have obscured the meaning of King's the Southern Freedom Movement with Northern Progressivism, mm-hmm. which is highly materialistic. King was not a progressive because he said one of the most troubling things are moderate white people and white people who say that they're liberal. Sometimes they're more problematic than outright racist. And so that I think that white progressive movements in the North had always had to struggle with this racism. King was part of a movement that had begun with black people, as I pointed out, all the way back to enslavement and the runaway slave movement. It is a total misreading of history to keep talking about Stacey Abrams as being a progressive, as if her roots are in a Northern progressive, liberal progressive ideology. In fact, she's a daughter of Fannie Lou Hamer. She's a daughter of the Southern Freedom Movement. Mm-hmm. Her roots are deeply Southern, and that's why whenever she talks about her work, she makes a connection between spirituality and her political impulse.
I've Been to the Mountaintop is the popular name for the last speech that Martin Luther King Jr. delivered. That was on April 3, 1968, at the Mason Temple in Memphis, Tennessee. The speech primarily concerns the Memphis sanitation strike. Let's take a listen to part of that.
Let us develop a kind of dangerous unselfishness. One day a man came to Jesus, and he wanted to raise some questions about some vital matters of life. At points, he wanted to trick Jesus and show him that he knew a little more than Jesus knew and throw him off base. Now, that question could have easily ended up in a philosophical and theological debate. But Jesus immediately pulled that question from midair and placed it on a dangerous curve between Jerusalem and Jericho. He talked about a certain man who fell among thieves. You remember that a Levite and a priest passed by on the other side. They didn't stop to help him. Finally, a man of another race came by. He got down from his beast, decided not to be compassionate by proxy. But he got down with him, administered first aid, and helped the man in need. Jesus ended up saying this was the good man, this was the great man, because he had the capacity to project the eye into the thou and to be concerned about his brother. Now, you know, we use our imagination a great deal to try to determine why the priest and the Levite didn't stop. The times we say they were busy going to a church meeting, an ecclesiastical gathering, and they had to get on down to Jerusalem so they wouldn't be late for their meeting. At other times, we would speculate that there was a religious law that one who was engaged in religious ceremonial was not to touch a human body 24 hours before the ceremony. And every now and then we begin to wonder whether maybe they were not going down to Jerusalem, down to Jericho rather, to organize a Jericho Road Improvement Association. That's a possibility. Maybe they felt that it was better to deal with the problem from the causal root rather than to get bogged down with an individual effect. But I'm going to tell you what my imagination tells me. It's possible that those men were afraid. You see, the Jericho Road is a dangerous road.
That's right, that's right.
I remember when Mrs. King and I were first in Jerusalem. We rented a car and drove from Jerusalem down to Jericho. And as soon as we got on that road, I said to my wife, I can see why Jesus used this as the setting for his parable. It's a winding, meandering road. It's really conducive for ambushing. You start out in Jerusalem, which is about 1,200 miles, or rather 1,200 feet above sea level. And by the time you get down to Jericho, 15 or 20 minutes later, you're about 2,200 feet below sea level. That's a dangerous road. In the days of Jesus, it came to be known as the Bloody Pass. You know, it's possible that the priest and the Levite looked over that man on the ground and wondered if the robbers were still around. Or it's possible that they felt that the man on the ground was merely faking. And he was acting like he had been robbed and hurt in order to seize them over there, lure them there for quick and easy seizure. And so the first question that the priest asked, the first question that the Levite asked was, if I stop to help this man, what will happen to me? But then the Good Samaritan came by, and he reversed the question. If I do not stop to help this man, what will happen to him? That's the question before you tonight. Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to my job? Not if I stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to all of the hours that I usually spend in my office every day and every week as a pastor? The question is not if I stop to help this man in need, what will happen to me? The question is, if I do not stop to help the sanitation workers, what will happen to them? That's the question. Let us rise up tonight with a greater readiness. Let us stand with a greater determination. And let us move on in these powerful days, these days of challenge, to make America what it ought to be. We have an opportunity to make America a better nation. And I want to thank God once more for allowing me to be here with you. You know, several years ago, I was in New York City autographing the first book that I had written. And while sitting there autographing books, a demented black woman came up. The only question I heard from her was, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And I was looking down writing, and I said, "Yes." And the next minute, I felt something beating on my chest. Before I knew it, I had been stabbed by this demented woman. I was rushed to Harlem Hospital. It was a dark Saturday afternoon. That blade had gone through, and the x-rays revealed that the tip of the blade was on the edge of my aorta, the main artery. And once that's punctured, you're drowned in your own blood. That's the end of you. It came out in the New York Times the next morning that if I had merely sneezed, I would have died. Well, about 4 days later, they allowed me, after the operation, after my chest had been opened and the blade had been taken out, to move around in the wheelchair in the hospital. They allowed me to read some of the mail that came in, and from all over the states and the world, kind letters came in. I read a few, but one of them I will never forget. I had received one from the president and the vice president. I've forgotten what those telegrams said. I'd received a visit and a letter from the governor of New York, but I've forgotten what that letter said. But there was another letter that came from a little girl, a young girl, who was a student at the White Plains High School. And I looked at that letter, and I'll never forget it. It said simply, "Dear Dr. King, I am a ninth grade student at the White Plains High School. She said, while it should not matter, I would like to mention that I'm a white girl. I read in the paper of your misfortune and of your suffering. And I read that if you had sneezed, you would have died. And I'm simply writing you to say that I'm so happy that you didn't sneeze. And I want to say tonight, that I too am happy that I didn't sneeze, because if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1960 when students all over the South started sitting in at lunch counters. And I knew that as they were sitting in, they were really standing up for the best in the American dream and taking the whole nation back to those great wells of democracy which were dug deep by the founding fathers in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1961 when we decided to take a ride for freedom and ended segregation in interstate travel. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been around here in 1962 when Negroes in Albany, Georgia decided to straighten their backs up. And whenever men and women straighten their backs up, they are going somewhere, because a man can't ride your back unless it is bent. If I had sneezed, if I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been here in 1963. And the black people of Birmingham, Alabama, aroused the conscience of this nation and brought into being the Civil Rights Bill. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have had a chance later that year in August to try to tell America about a dream that I had had. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been down in Selma, Alabama to see the great movement there. If I had sneezed, I wouldn't have been in Memphis to see a community rally around those brothers and sisters who are suffering. I'm so happy that I didn't sneeze. And they were telling me, now it doesn't matter now. It really doesn't matter what happens now. I left Atlanta this morning, and as we got started on the plane, there were six of us. The pilot said over the public address system, "We are sorry for the delay, but we have Dr. Martin Luther King on the plane, and to be sure that all of the bags were checked, and to be sure that nothing would be wrong on the plane, we had to check out everything carefully, and we've had the plane protected and guarded all night." And then I got into Memphis, and some began to say the threats, or talk about the threats that were out, or what would happen to me from some of our sick white brothers. Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And he's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
That was part of Martin Luther King Jr.'s I've Been to the Mountaintop speech from April 3rd, 1968.
When I put out a few months ago the book White Lives Matter Most and Other Little White Lives, the fact is I wanted to recognize a group of indigenous women leaders, Lilla Watson and others, who are attributed with saying, if you have come here to help me, you're wasting your time. But if you have come here because your liberation is bound up with mine, then let us work together. It's that kind of alliance. It's that kind of radical coming together that we obviously need today. And I'm interested in hearing, Ruby and Emma, your last words about this as we close up the program.
I think that that whole notion of White Lives Matter must be nuanced on several levels. The notion that white skin matters more than all other skin is the foundation of white supremacy. At the same time, I think that we have to understand that all white lives do not carry the same currency and meaning and value. And so the question, once again, is speaking in double tones rather than in a dialectic. It's speaking in simultaneous, speaking in tones. I also think that in order to be a freedom fighter, you have to also have dreams. If you don't have dreams, so Martin Luther King was part of a common dream. That's why I keep using the word common dream. He was not the only dreamer. Black folk had dreamed this new world coming into being for generations and had worked to build it when there was no evidence that their work would ever bear fruit, but they kept on building generations. And so it's really important not to, once again, create an either, you're either a dreamer or you're a worker. And I think the other thing about, I think that what we have to all look at is the efficacy of our lives and to ask the question, are we more than skin? Are we also gender? Are we also sexuality? Are we also class? Are we also race? And how do we rebuild ourselves in a society that has reduced our lives to just the color of our skin? And because we see ourselves in terms of skin color, sometimes we end up invariably voting against our other identities, voting against the interests of our whole selves. And so that I think that we have to develop in the 21st century a way of talking in tongues about what does it mean to be engaged in a freedom struggle. I also think that it's very important in the 21st century to develop a new language. I argue that it's not a question of white privilege. It's a question of rights. White supremacy denies black people of our rights based on our skin and based on the assumption that only white people are entitled to civil and human rights. Anybody can have privilege. I have privilege as a black woman who's educated. So privilege is obviously not what we want. We want rights. And so as long as people think that they have privilege, what makes them want to change? It is not a privilege to be stripped of all of your identities and to just be called a skin, to be skin, just to be white. That is an existential spiritual suicide and murder. It is not a privilege to be reduced. The gift is to be able to live into the fullness of oneself. And so as long as people think that they have privilege and not be honest that it's really rights that they have and not understand that to be stripped bare is not a privilege, it's a death sentence. I think, so we've got to develop a new language. We've got to stop talking about inclusion. That's problematic because that assumes, the implicit assumption is that somebody owns the table with the power to include. So we have to talk about democratizing the table rather than including people in the table. So even we talk about sites of terror where immigrants are held captive. We call them detention centers. that sanitizes the brutal nature of what's going on and the ethnic cleansing that that represents. And so we have got to develop a new freedom language that represents the realities of what we're dealing with. As long as we speak in the empire tongue, we cover the pernicious and brutal nature of empire oppression. And so I think that I call, and so even though we think we're being radical, our tongues still carry the marks of empire. Finally, let me say that what Martin Luther King understood, that nothing that we created in terms of rights would have any meaning unless we have a transformation of values. And he made it very clear throughout his work that first and foremost he was a preacher. So every time he talked, he was not giving a speech, he was mm-hmm. preaching a sermon. And so at Memphis, he summed up his life by saying that, I just want to do God's will. And so the question for us, what was God's will in the eyes of MLK? And that will was to let justice roll down like the waters and righteousness like a steady stream. And so that he always, always talked about movement as a higher level of consciousness. The mountaintop was not a place. It was a higher level of consciousness where we cleared empire cataracts out of our eyes and that we were able to see each other and ourselves more clear, in a more clearer fashion. And so I think that we've got to stop thinking about movement as a materialist proposition that's devoid from an inner life of a higher consciousness. And I think that the real challenge for the 21st century is to move away from a Marxist analysis that says that the highest epicenter of human existence is economics and material.
Sister Ruby Sales, thank you so, so much.
Ruby Sales, the Reverend Emma Jordan Simpson, and Matt Meyer, it has been an honor to spend this hour with you remembering the values and the work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.